And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Energy is a core issue for the world, and Trump's response, well, it's more fracking, more gas, and coal export terminals, and more projects like Keystone XL and Dakota Access Pipeline as he dumps the Paris Accord on climate change.
Trump is unprepared to accept the science of climate change and unwilling to join the effort being made across the globe through the Paris Climate Accord. Trump is digging a ditch. The only difference between a ditch and a grave is that one is normally a little deeper than the other.
And we stole that from our guest.
Oh, is that where you got that from?
Absolutely. As Trump seeks to bury climate justice policies, we'll talk about what are the policies we need to push for and the actions to turn up the pressure to save the planet and create green jobs. Don't dump on the environment, dump the Trump. And Sean Sweeney is the one who I absolutely plagiarized that comment from, and I love it. The difference between a ditch and a grave is that one is normally a little deeper than the other. Sean Sweeney is the director and founder of the Murphy Institute's International Program on Labor, Climate, and the Environment. And thanks for joining us. So your thoughts on the U.S. removing from the Paris Climate Accord?
The Paris Agreement was obviously an important development in the effort to control greenhouse gas emissions. It was not an agreement to reduce emissions. That's a bit of a misconception. But nevertheless, there were 180 or so countries made commitments in the years leading to the Paris talks that were regarded as a sort of very serious moment and an important breakthrough in the effort, the global effort, to control runaway global warming by reducing emissions. So to pull out of that agreement is a very serious backward step. That said, there is room here to organize and to address, I believe, the weaknesses, not just in the agreement, but the actual U.S. commitment to the Paris Accord, which was really very, very weak. It really didn't live up to where the U.S. should be in terms of its national responsibilities. The U.S. is responsible for about 30% of accumulated emissions, which is the emissions that are in the atmosphere now, which is causing the warming. It's presently, although it's only 5% of the world's population, it's responsible for 17% of emissions annually. And the average U.S. person emits about 17 tons of CO2 equivalent every year. So we're talking about a big footprint and a big contribution to the problem of global warming. So to walk out of that agreement is a serious problem.
You know, Sean, there's been more talk about climate change with the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, but where has the media been for the last 2 months when Trump has been laying the basis for pipelines for gas and oil, when he has been eviscerating the EPA, when there's been layoffs in the EPA in terms of enforcement of the law with regard to emissions, and any number of different things? What has Trump's record been so far as president?
Well, the media has been supporting it, but...
But what concrete things has he done so far against the environment?
Well, it's hard to keep up with everything, of course, and I guess the media is responding to all sorts of other day-to-day crises and issues. We saw this coming really in the election campaign. There was the commitment to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, which was the largest project of its kind, 1,700 miles of pipeline from the Alberta tar sands in Canada to Saudi-owned refineries in the Gulf. And that's an export carbon strategy. And so is everything else, the fracking, the coal. It's mostly aimed towards the movement of shale oil and gas and tar oil to refineries for export. This is the strategists of the oil, coal, and gas industries understand that energy consumption in the U.S. is flat and falling. And this is largely due to the recession and deindustrialization, with a little bit also to do with more wind and solar coming into the energy mix, but that's a really minor factor. But what's really being pushed is an export carbon America first agenda, misnamed because it's actually exporting emissions and pollution to other parts of the world. So everything Trump has done up until now, whether it be the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, the approval of offshore drilling and removal regulations for the Arctic drilling, which is something Obama stood up against, that is all pointing in the direction of so-called America First energy policy, which is to put the U.S. as an energy superpower, supplying the world with fossil fuels well into the future.
I hear very much what you're saying about the inadequacy in many ways of the Paris Accord. There's an emotional devastation. There's a demoralization because behind this is a complete disdain for the science, a complete dismissiveness of what we see happening, which is the from environmental racism to the broader conceptualization of the heating of the climate and so much more. So in order not to be completely shattered by this removal, even from this gesture, which is certainly has an international politic that's not unimportant, what do we begin to do? How do we mobilize? What are some of the ways? Also that the working class and the organized labor movement, who has hardly made this the fulcrum of their agenda, can get involved to compensate to some degree for the backwardness of the Trump administration on the issue of climate justice.
Right. I think the worst thing to happen is not pulling out of the agreement. The worst thing to happen is to allow that horrendous decision to demoralize us and make us feel that it's yet another catastrophic defeat. We have time to reverse this situation. The agreement doesn't kick in and come into effect until 2020. And that was already too much of a delay, in my opinion. One of the weaknesses of the Paris Agreement was that sort of delay in actually coming into effect in terms of when countries had to reach their targets. The other thing to be said about it is there are two components to the agreement. First of all, there's the national commitments that governments have made. And the U.S.'s commitment, as you said, was quite weak. It wasn't much better than a business-as-usual trajectory. The government did nothing. Emissions would have fallen slightly anyway because of the conversion from coal to gas. More gas coming into the system reduces the level of emissions, or rather it's a less dirty fuel than coal, as long as you don't factor in the methane coming from fracking, for example. So there's a debate to be had now to say, what if we go back into the Paris Agreement 2 years from now? Let's talk about post-Trump here, where however long that may take. What needs to be done now is we need to say that the commitment that U.S. made to Paris was already inadequate. And so were the commitments made by a lot of other countries. So we shouldn't just single out the U.S. for its weak commitment. The accumulation of those commitments were very, very inadequate. So this is an opportunity, I think, to go back and rethink what Paris was and how to raise the level of ambition in the talks as they proceed in the years ahead. And I think that would be a very important thing to do.
Sean, I know you've thought very deeply about what needs to be done, and we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes. Mm. So give us a taste of it. And we'll have to ask you back later on to really give us a full-blown analysis of what really needs to be done. But give us an introduction.
One of the things we need to point out about Paris is, first of all, it was a voluntary agreement. So countries said what they wanted to do is aspirational targets. To reach the other part of the agreement, which is important, which is the science-based targets, that's net zero emissions by 2060 and well below 2 degrees of warming is the threshold. To reach those targets needs literally a revolution in production and consumption. There needs to be, and this is the International Energy Agency talking now, not me. This is talking about revolutionary changes needed, particularly in the way power is generated and energy is used. So if we start from that standing point, we say, what's the best chance we have of reaching those science-based targets? Forget the national commitments for now. And we have to be looking at the kind of policies that, for example, the Roosevelt administration put in place during the Rural Electrification Administration in the 1930s, where every home virtually within 20 years was all the rural areas were converted to electricity. And that's the kind of speed and scale we need to really have the U.S. and the world do what's needed to address the emissions crisis and the warming crisis. But that's going to take a real paradigm shift in policy and a movement towards more towards what Bernie Sanders is saying in his climate change legislation that he submitted to the Senate a few weeks ago.
You are deeply immersed in the instruction of and support and activism around organized labor. The organized union movement has been limited, oftentimes backward, at times pitting jobs against the environment. What do people who see the primacy of the working class and its organizations do to really pressure labor to use what can be a mighty fist to reverse itself and get immersed in the climate issues, or worse, not to wind up supporting the handful of momentary jobs, for example, that were created at enormous expense on things like the Dakota Access Pipeline?
There's a lot of progress has been made. There have a lot of people talk to the negative sides of trade union and labor politics around energy and their support for Trump's infrastructure and energy agenda. But there are nurses unions, there are transport unions, there are postal worker unions coming forward now saying we are an energy union as well. We have as much of a dog in this race, skin in this game as anybody else, because we represent people who are suffering from the expanding use of fossil fuels. We see the victims of pollution every day, and we know what a warming world means. The Nurses Union, National Nurses United, and NYSNA in this state sent thousands of nurses to the Philippines to do emergency relief after Typhoon Yolanda devastated a large part of a corridor through the country and killed 6,000 to 7,000 people. So there's a beginning of a resistance in the labor movement to that dominant energy agenda, and there are many, many good people in the building trades, many good locals, Local 3 being one of them, who are supporting a progressive climate and energy policy for the United States that can create jobs and address the climate crisis at the same time. So there are many things to be encouraged about in terms of trade union involvement with this.
And as Ken said, this is just an introduction, but we have to punctuate it now. And in the next minute or so, what is to be done? How do we move forward?
The marches are important. The protests are important. But when it comes to energy and climate, the labor movement and its allies need to do some really serious programmatic work. They need to show what an energy future would look like based on renewable energy, where the union jobs would be in that sector. And the most important thing there is to deploy public renewable power. Private renewable power is what divides the labor movement. We have the solar industry. The installers are fighting against the manufacturers. It's chaos. The only way we're going to be able to rise to this challenge as a civilization is to take a needs-based public goods approach and not let investors and millionaires get in the way of what needs to be done to save the planet for future generations.
Sean Sweeney, we can't thank you enough for being with us.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you, Ken.
And we will
thank you later
so.
On because we need to flesh out this vision that you have.
And now, as promised, Mimi continues the discussion with Sean Sweeney on workers' union and climate change. What needs to be done?
Holly Neer, power. I want to just get into an area that you've really specialized in. I want you to talk about trade unions for, well, there are specific groups like trade unions for energy democracy, but one of the things that's been very troubling in this country, and of course Trump easily played to it, is pitting the issue of climate change and climate justice against the creation and maintenance of jobs. And I want you just to kind of, to begin with, to flesh out that contradiction for us. Or is it a contradiction and rather a manipulation by the Trump administration as to the decimation of coal jobs and placing the Dakota Access Pipeline and things like that into the frame, saying, well, you know, these climate positions and climate justice efforts are job destroyers, or they maintain that the countries gain a financial advantage over the United States by having been involved in the Paris Accords. Flesh out some of those issues for us, if you will.
Well, it's let's take up the question of job destruction and job creation. The more clean energy and green industries that can be developed, the more jobs are created. We don't have to look very far for that. Germany's wind employment, wind power, is in the realm of 300,000 jobs. That's about five times more, by four times the number of U.S. mop pit workers working at coal faces or in mountain in open cast mining in the United States. The solar industry is also large, particularly in Germany on the installation side, where in 1 year, Germany installed more solar power than the United States had installed over the last 15 years. So there's definitely jobs in renewable energy. There's jobs in energy conservation. There's jobs in organic and low carbon transport and organic agriculture. So the job data show that the more aggressive a country or region is in pursuing a climate protection agenda, the more jobs will be created. And those jobs are more dispersed across the economy. So the jobs argument is often severely distorted by the likes of Trump. Now, in terms of job destruction, I think it's worth bearing in mind that rather in the last few years, since the slump in oil and gas prices, 100,000 workers in extraction of oil and gas lost their job during this price slump. And the slump was largely caused by economics. The shale gas industry, fracking industry essentially in the United States, put so much gas into the U.S. economy that the gas price plummeted. And that meant to get acceptable returns for the companies, they had to pursue an export strategy. This is also true of oil. Oil consumption in the United States, like gas, is flat and even falling to some extent. And that's got very little to do with environmental policy. That's more to do with the savage recession of 2008, 2009, and all of the deindustrialization that went on in the United States. So a lot of the pipeline fights, refinery fights that we're seeing, they seem to be proliferating, pipelines everywhere. That's because the oil and gas industry, because of fracking, they frack for oil as well as gas, that the fracking industry has generated so much surplus that they need to get that stuff to market. And that means getting pipelines to export terminals on the coast to build those terminals and supply an energy-hungry markets in China, India, and elsewhere, also Europe and Japan. So that's the sort of the economics of energy that often gets lost in some of these debates over fossil fuels. So the job numbers, the number of active coal miners in the United States is in the realm of about 85,000. When you think that 1.3 million workers work for Walmart, it's not a particularly high number. Those jobs, of course, are precious to those communities. But most mining, or a growing percentage now of mining in the United States, in basically open cast mining, blowing up mountains in places like Wyoming and Montana, I think that's like 45% of U.S. coal production now. It's no longer in the Appalachian areas. It's moved west. It's mostly non-union. And there is a surplus of coal in the United States that can't be sold at the moment. It really is a no-brainer. Climate jobs, the pursuit of an aggressive emissions reductions agenda locally and nationally is the best way to create jobs and also to protect the health of people and the long-term stability of the ecosystems and to make sure that wealth is more equally distributed.
Talk about trade unions for energy democracy. You are the director of a climate-based program within the Murphy Institute, and on a national scale, look at the issue of labor and climate and the environment. And many of, certainly the building trades unions, have been really reactionary when it comes to energy policies, etc., which we can certainly get into. But more specifically, let's look at the progressive efforts and the trade unions for energy democracy. What are the policies that are emerging?
Well, Trade Unions for Energy Democracy is almost 5 years old, and we had a global network of unions who are committed to or open to the idea of reclaiming energy systems on the basis of a framework called Resist, Reclaim, Restructure. The resist is to fight the introduction of more and the deployment of more and more fossil fuels, infrastructure, use, technologies. We have to stop this madness before it destroys all of us. The health statistics are low. Every year, according to the World Health Organization, 1 in 7 million people have their lives cut short because of poor air quality and other fossil fuel-related conditions. So this is a health emergency. So the unions around the world, though, have been caught in the middle of something. On the one side, you have the corporations who say environmentalists and climate policy and regulations are going to kill your job. And the other side of the argument is the environmental movement, what is sometimes the mainstream environmental bodies, have been, up until fairly recently, quite agnostic about worker issues. They take the view that renewable energy by any means necessary is the way to go. If that means multinational corporations charging high prices, moving into communities, some cases seizing land, as in Oaxaca, Mexico, then that's the price we have to pay in order to have clean and renewable energy. So there's good guys in the capitalist class. There are good guys and bad guys, and we need to support the good guys. That was kind of an untenable position for most unions. Whether or not you're in the fossil fuel sector, unions are aware that this is, in many ways, amounts to a sort of handing over public electricity systems, which you've seen over the years, handed over to private investors, renewables companies coming in and negotiating very, very expensive power purchase agreements with government bodies to produce renewable power. That model of deploying renewable energy was just not succeeding. There's not enough private investment out there coming into renewable energy. Essentially, without the power purchase agreement, without what is essentially a subsidy, most investors are worried that someone like Trump is going to come along and cancel renewables programs, cancel solar and wind programs. They're also worried that the price of oil and gas will continue to be low, and that undercuts electricity generated from renewable power. So there's a price war going on, which really shouldn't happen. In a sane world, we would say, okay, so renewable energy is a couple of cents a kilowatt hour more expensive than coal-fired or gas-fired energy. you know, when you factor in all the health impacts and climate-related diseases and other impacts, then fossil fuel energy is more expensive. So from a public goods point of view, the price of electrical power at any given hour shouldn't be driving the decision of whether we actually go toward renewables or not. So Trade Unions for Energy Democracy is fighting for public goods approaches to large-scale renewable energy deployment, which means we do sufficient amounts of renewables. In the U.S., wind and solar contribute around 6% of the U.S.'s electricity supply and about 4% of U.S. consumption of electricity. We really need to be up to 30, 40, 50, 60 and more percent, and we need to do that in the next 10, 15, 20 years. And that level of deployment can only happen with as a public goods approach, where the electricity is provided as a public service, but it's also the revenues that are invested in it are returned through the cost of electricity in a fair and an equitable manner. So public ownership, democratic control, municipal control of electricity systems, we feel is a key component, both in terms of job creation, in terms of reaching the targets that were adopted in Paris, and also pushing back the political power of fossil fuel companies who largely have politicians in their pocket, not just in this country, but in many other countries of the world as well. So that's the essence of the project. There are 50-something unions in it now and from 18 countries. And for your listeners, unionsforenergydemocracy.org, if you want to check out some of the research and some of the bulletins there that are on the website.
Well, Sean Sweeney, director and founder of the Murphy Institute's International Program on Labor, Climate, and the Environment, thank you for that comprehensive prima on energy and energy policies that we need to pursue in the wake of the pullout from the climate accord in Paris. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Marie, and good luck to you and all your listeners. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.